A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Now, we're going to do something a little bit different from what we normally do. We'll not have a armed citizen story for you or a good deed of the day or a recidivist report. That's because we have a lengthy conversation with Peter Ficelli. He is the author of the new book, The Deadly Path, How Operation Fast and Furious and Bad Lawyers Armed Mexican Drug Cartels. Pete was one of the whistleblowers that alerted Congress to the existence of Operation Fast and Furious. He is a retired deputy assistant director of the ATF, spent 15 years with the NYPD before joining the ATF. And when he was assigned to the Phoenix, Arizona field office, that is when Pete's story really picks up. Now, I will tell you, this book, I read it in basically one sitting. Read the first couple of chapters, had to set it aside to do some work, and then I polished off the rest of the book the evening that I first cracked it open. It is incredibly engaging. It is infuriating. I would say if you do not know anything at all about Operation Fast and Furious, this is probably not the book to start. It helps to have a background in what Operation Fast and Furious was all about. But Pete was sort of there, not on the front lines. He wasn't working directly with Operation Fast and Furious, but he was in the same field office where Fast and Furious was taking place. He heard the rumors, heard the scuttlebutt, and eventually heard the official accounts of what this ATF operation was doing in letting guns walk across the border into Mexico, into the hands of the drug cartels. Now, I will tell you that when I sat down to start reading this book, I was hoping to get an answer to a question that I've been asking since I first learned about Operation Fast and Furious more than a decade ago. How was this supposed to work? How was this supposed to work? You know, we were told, well, we're going to let the guns go across the border. We're going to track them. They had no way to track them. When we find these guns in the hands of the cartel leaders, well, we'll be able to swoop in and, make these arrests. That didn't happen. That wasn't going to happen. And in Pete's book, he lays out why that was never going to happen. But not only that, why this entire strategy was, it just flew in the face of everything that was happening with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Phoenix. The idea of letting guns walk across the border, the U.S. Attorney's Office wasn't taking cases when they had guns in hand, much less, guns in a foreign country. As a matter of fact, once the guns had crossed over to Mexico, the U.S. Attorney's Office was regularly telling the ATF, sorry, we don't have a case anymore because the gun is in Mexico. So I have to say, I am left with even more questions after reading Pete's book. But I would encourage you to pick up a copy, as well as to listen to the entire conversation with Pete Ficelli and myself about Operation Fast and Furious, why he decided to come forward, and the questions that he still has about this disturbing attempt to walk guns into Mexico. Not just attempt. I mean, they were successful at doing so. More than 1,000 firearms walking into the hands of the cartels. Yeah, Pete still has some questions, too. Take a look and a listen. Pete, thanks so much for coming on the program today. It's really, really great to talk with you.
Honored to be here. I'm a big fan of your work.
Well, I got to say, I appreciate that. You and I were on this Newsmax panel earlier last week. And as soon as we got done talking, I was like, I got to reach out. I want to have him on the show. And then I realized that you had just written this book, The Deadly Path, How Operation Fast and Furious and Bad Lawyers Armed Mexican Cartels. And I got to tell you, I covered Fast and Furious when the story broke. We had, Mr. Dobson on the program. We have spoken to Brian Terry's family. I thought I knew pretty much everything there was to know about Operation Fast and Furious. And then I started reading your book and I realized, oh, you know what? There's a whole story to be told about what led up to Fast and Furious. And so before we even get into that operation, I wonder if you can just talk about, because this is something that really surprised me, the friction and the tension that existed between the ATF in Phoenix and the U.S. Attorney's Office in Phoenix when you arrived in Phoenix to start working for the ATF there.
Sure. Well, I had worked in New York with the U.S. Attorney's Office going after some really violent people, murderers, home invaders, things like that. And we used violations of the Gun Control Act often as a means to get them in the door. you know, and then with the purpose of proffering them, following the information. So when I got out to Phoenix, I was expecting something similar. But what I saw was the U.S. Attorney's office there was incredibly disengaged. And we weren't going after folks who were selling guns to other people who were going target shooting and hunting. Basically, the cases that my folks were doing were going after folks who were trafficking firearms to Mexico. I mean, you know, which was what Fast and Furious was all about. So, but when they would get calls, and almost invariably the calls came from licensed dealers, you know, who would tell us, hey, guy just walked in with a bag full of money. He asked how many rifles I had on the shelf, said, I'll take them all. And usually these were the AK variants or the AR-15 platform rifles. So the dealers were the source of information for us. We would roll out there. We would let the deal take place. We would follow the car off site because we'd want to endanger the dealer or customers in the gun shop. We would do a car stop and ask probative questions, you know, build up probable cause like cops do all over the country. And almost without fail, we would be told, let them go. We can indict them later, or, hey, take it to the county. But what I found was in the cases where there weren't an underlying county violation, these cases would never get indicted. So these individuals would continue to supply firearms to folks who were trafficking them into Mexico. And, you know, during this time, keep in mind, I would also get information from Mexico through National Drug Intelligence Center bulletins about what was happening down there. So I'd see images, you know, pictures of people skinned, presumably alive and left for dead in showers, people hung from bridges, decapitated bodies, mass graves. So when you see what's happening in Mexico and then you see this complete just lack of engagement from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Phoenix, it was a difficult thing to stomach. And I really, to this day, can't understand why they took the positions they took.
Yeah, I mean, it's inexplicable, particularly when they did approve these Fast and Furious cases, right, which we'll get into in a second. So you've got the dysfunction and this very, again, hands-off attitude from the U.S. Attorney's Office. You also, it seems like, had a great deal of dysfunction within the ATF field office in Phoenix. You write about Rene Jacques, who, when you were assigned to Phoenix, you got there. He's working from home because of, personal conflicts with another member of the office. And at one point, Pete, I was amazed to read this. At one point, your boss says, hey, can you go by? I can't get a hold of Rene. He hasn't filled out his time card. You go, the driveway is, you know, got papers, there's mail in the mailbox. You're afraid you're going to find a dead body in the home. And instead, when you hop the fence and his neighbor comes out armed, wondering what's going on, and you explain who you are, he says, oh, he's in Colombia. He's down there teaching salsa classes. That just boggled my mind, that here you have a federal employee who apparently is, you know, taking off these international jaunts, and there's no oversight taking place with the personnel in the office. What was the ATF Phoenix office like compared to the working environment, the professional environment that you had in New York?
Well, look, in New York, we worked a lot with the police department. We did in Phoenix as well. In New York, agents, look, there wasn't a lot of personalities. I mean, it was more about the mission. When I got to Phoenix, I was shocked because Bill Newell, who was the special agent in charge, was a brand new special agent in charge, very inexperienced guy, one of the nicest guys I ever worked for, but incredibly inexperienced. And then the ASAC, which is the number two of the office, didn't get along with some of the group supervisors for personality reasons. They were basically, for the most part, told to stay home and think about what you did. So, which is like unheard of, like it wasn't any kind of discipline. So you had people just kind of sitting in the various, in their houses doing work from home. So yeah, Rene wasn't filling out his timesheets. So I was sent to go check up on him. And like you pointed out, you know, see the mail popping out of the mailbox. I see, you know, flyers littering their driveway. I thought he was dead, frankly. But yeah, that was interesting. But yeah, it was just incredible dysfunction. But it wasn't just limited to ATF either. It was, I mean, I know there's another chapter about what was going on with the FBI, who didn't like one of my agents who was having really good results going after some Aryan Brotherhood folks. So they tried to smear him as somebody who was engaged in conduct that he wasn't engaged in. It was demonstrably false. So, I mean, just the law enforcement community in Phoenix in general was just unlike anything I had ever seen. And which, you know, I think led to some of the dysfunction that created a climate where Fast and Furious could even happen.
So that is my big question, because, you know, again, you've got this situation where the U.S. Attorney's Office isn't taking your cases. You know, in fact, their argument at one point was corpus delicti, right? That, well, the guns are now in Mexico. So how can we prosecute these cases when the evidence is down there in Mexico? How do you go from that to approving these cases where we're going to let the guns walk into Mexico and then somehow we'll make an arrest afterwards? Have you ever gotten an explanation as to how the U.S. Attorney's Office signed off on Fast and Furious in these cases?
No, but I mean, what you pointed out, I mean, it shows the schizophrenic just way things were operating in Phoenix, because you're right. I mean, we had cases where we had traffickers who brought guns to Mexico. One of them I mentioned specifically was a case where a kid was trafficking. He was young, like 20s, trafficking 50 caliber Barretts to the Juarez cartel. So one of them is used to kill a Mexican police commander in a daycare center. So when we present that case, we're told, well, the gun's in Mexico, the corpus delicti, the body of the crime's in Mexico. This is the same prosecutor, by the way, who later is quarterbacking Operation Fast and Furious, where their strategy is let the guns go to Mexico. We can track the locations where they're recovered to identify which cartel operatives are involved in this trafficking scheme, and we may be able to take down this faction of the cartel. And when you think about it, it's delusional. And I said this as much when I testified in front of Congress. DEA had a very robust presence in Mexico. They had phenomenal intelligence assets down there. They had vetted units, folks who were polygraphed, who were operating for them down there. We didn't have any of the above. So the thought that we would even think that we could take down a cartel with straw purchasing laws, when you look at DEA had the narcotics trafficking conspiracy laws, which are actually quite powerful, it made no sense. But again, you had prosecutors from the Phoenix U.S. Attorney's Office that were fully on board with this. And then we didn't even mention the grenade guy. I mean, it's just completely... To this day, I mean, I have had over a decade to try to figure out what was going through their heads, and I still can't figure it out. But what I do know is when Fast and Furious was happening, there was a lot of excitement in the Phoenix office, and I heard that translated to headquarters, and I wasn't in the meetings, about Demand Letter 3, which was the, you know, as you know, required the FFLs in the border states to fill out multiple sale forms for rifle purchases, which didn't exist pre-Fast and Furious. And which is kind of scary. And again, I didn't put it in the book because I tried to stick with stuff I physically saw or witnessed as opposed to speculating. But I mean, if Brian Terry died because ATF wanted to implement Demand Letter 3, I can't think of a more appalling thing that's ever happened in federal law enforcement.
You know, do you think that that was one of the reasons for Fast and Furious, that they were hoping to enact policy changes by letting these guns walk across the border?
I think, you know, there's that theory that they say never let a good crisis go to waste.
Yeah.
I don't know that that's what started Fast and Furious, but I know that there was discussions while Fast and Furious would happen, or while it was happening, that, hey, this would be a good opportunity to put out this Demand Letter 3. So, I mean, one way or the other, they are related. Whether that was the cause of Fast and Furious or not, I can't say because I wasn't present for any of those discussions.
Do you know who came up with the idea of Operation Fast and Furious? I mean, I know that Hope McAllister was basically running this at one point, but was she the one who said, hey, let's do this? Or who came up with this idea of let's let these guns walk? We can trace them once they're found at crime scenes. And then we can, you know, hopefully nail the cartel leaders.
I'm not sure if it was Hope, who I knew and who I worked for, who I went through the academy with. Or perhaps George Gillette or Newell, Bill Newell. I don't know which one. I know that Hope was averse to car stops. She didn't think it was our job. In fact, when they were doing trafficking cases, they would often call uniformed cops to stop cars for us. I had a problem with that. I was a uniformed cop. I was a policeman with NYPD for 15 years before I came on with ATF. But ATF agents get paid pretty well. And we have lights and sirens in our vehicles. And I wasn't going to have some cop do what I viewed to be our job in stopping cars and asking questions, because you're asking them to put themselves in harm's way. And again, I'm not saying anybody who has a gun is a threat, but these folks were trafficking guns to cartels. I viewed them as potentially being dangerous people. So, but Hope was averse to stopping cars. And Hope had a case earlier, which led to her getting transferred to my group for a short time, which is my group wasn't involved in Fast and Furious, for the record. But Hope had a case that had preceded her time in my group where they followed guns to Mexico. Mexico was aware, and then the guns made it across the border. And my understanding is they may have even seen Mexican border authorities helping transfer guns from the car they surveilled into another car, which is another whole story about the stuff that we used to see aduana, which is Mexican customs, do at the behest of cartel plaza bosses, you know, which, you know, that's why I laugh now, you know, and I'm not saying it's funny, that the government of Mexico is suing the gun manufacturers for some of the stuff happening here, when the reality is, you know, the Department of Justice could have did a better job. And so could Mexican customs have done a better job at preventing guns from making their way into Mexico.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, I don't want to go too far afield, but I think you're absolutely right about that. You know, the government corruption in Mexico. I mean, honestly, I don't even know if you've seen the story because it came out maybe a month ago and then it really hasn't gone anywhere. But apparently there was a DEA investigation into Mexico's current president, Obrador, back when he was running for president the first time. He didn't win. This was, I think, 2005. They were investigating his alleged cartel ties. One of his high-level campaign staffers apparently admitted to taking $4 million from the cartels in exchange for Obrador going easy on the cartels if he was elected. There was apparently another investigation that was started, I think, after AMLO was elected in 2018, but I guess the Biden administration put the kibosh on that investigation. So, I mean, you talk about the level of corruption within the cartels in the Mexican government. And it is rife. We know that the cartels are using, you know, municipal police forces to get guns illegally. The chiefs will, import them in from the United States and they'll hand them over to the cartels. They're getting from Mexican military sources. It's not like the only strategy for the cartels to arm themselves is to, you know, send some, you know, low-level straw buyer to a gun store in Arizona and say, buy as many guns as you can, right? This is a multinational, multi-billion dollar criminal enterprise. Honestly, I'm kind of surprised that they're not building and making their own firearms and ammunition at this point.
Oh, I believe they are. I can tell you back when I was still assigned to Phoenix in late 2011, maybe early 2012, ATF had information about a CNC machine that was crossing the border. And again, we had no authority to seize it. So I believe they have been making guns down there. In fact, in one of the chapters in my book, I talk about a gentleman who's lived in Yuma, American citizen, married to a Mexican police chief's daughter, who was taking the AR-15 platform rifles and the AK variant rifles that were being smuggled in from the U.S. into Mexico and converting them into fully automatic machine guns. And here's a guy who the U.S. Attorney's Office wouldn't prosecute. So, I mean, it makes you wonder what goes through some folks' minds, or was there a bigger political agenda that I just wasn't privy to? But it certainly flew in the face of common sense what was happening down there.
Yeah, and you know, that's the thing. This is not your book is a memoir. Right. So it is not. And I don't want people to get the wrong impression. In fact, I think folks should have a basic understanding of Fast and Furious before they read your book, because this is your take. This is what you saw, as you said. Right. You want to limit this to what you know and not a lot of speculation. But what you know, I think, again, is very revealing because you're not just able to talk about what you learned about Operation Fast and Furious, but you are able, again, to talk about the environment in which Operation Fast and Furious took place. And I kept going back to this, you know, the headbutting that you had with Emory Hurley in the U.S. Attorney's Office. And, you know, that constant, like, you can tell how deflated you and your team were, Pete, when you're writing about, you know, you didn't even want to take these cases to Emory Hurley because you knew what the answer would be. But office politics, right? You can't go to the county. You can't go to the attorney general's office who you set up a relationship with until the U.S. attorney had turned you down, right?
Right. Yes. Which sucked for the other entities because they felt like they were taking second bites at the apple. But the weird thing is, you know, Emory Hurley had replaced a girl named Rachel Hernandez, who was equally obstinate but less personable. Emory was actually a personable guy. And I actually liked Emory when he first took over that role. And I had some hope that maybe we would see some progress. Maybe we would start doing some of the things that police do all over the country. And I found out that he just wasn't. I mean, he wasn't amenable to doing things. And he would always find excuses as to why we couldn't do something, which look, as a leader was hard because I was a pretty successful agent in New York because I had those relationships with prosecutors, because you can't do things without those relationships. So I would watch some really good people who worked for me never make it to the next level because they could never get that buy-in from the prosecutor's office. So as a leader, to me, it was troubling to watch my people never reach their full potential because of things that were beyond their control. And then, you know, what happened was all of those cases they wouldn't indict. When John Dodson stepped forward to blow the whistle on Operation Fast and Furious, there were rumblings that the U.S. attorneys was going to indict John. And I hadn't even met John at that point. I don't think we ever had a conversation. I may have seen him at the range when we would all go and qualify. I'm not even sure that happened. But here I'm like, wait a minute. Time out. All of these people who were trafficking guns to murderers in Mexico, we won't prosecute, meaning the U.S. Attorney's Office. But now you're going to prosecute an agent who blew the whistle on Operation Fast and Furious. And that's what led me to come home to my wife and say, hey, this is what's going on. What do you think? And she was like, well, if you don't do the right thing, you're not the man I married, which led to me calling Grassley's office and saying, hey, I know that DOJ is telling you John Dodson is a liar. He's not. Let's have a conversation. And that's when, you know, my journey into the abyss started.
How much did you know about Fast and Furious at that point? Because as you say, you were the supervisor for Group One, right, which was not involved in Operation Fast and Furious. So what did you know at that point when you called Grassley's office and said, all right, here's what I can corroborate from John Dodson?
Well, not much, because the Group Seven, which was the Fast and Furious group, was in a different building. So I would attend meetings every week. We had a supervisors meeting where the group supervisors and myself and all the folks in Phoenix, and then people from Albuquerque or Tucson would call in, and we would talk about what was happening in the groups. And in Group Seven, the first discussion, I remember there was a case where they talked about 600 guns that they believe were trafficked to Mexico. And I wasn't sure, you know, where they came up with that number, because there were times where we would have, like, we had the Excalibur arms case where they did an inspection of the FFL and they found some strange records. And then they assumed that based on historical analysis of those documents, that these were a trafficking scheme and that the guns had made their way to Mexico based on that and some tracing information. So I assumed at that point, when Dave Voth was talking about the 600 guns, that they found a treasure trove of historical intelligence. But then at subsequent meetings, the numbers would go up and up. So I'd start asking questions like, hey, are you guys like stopping these cars and, you know, and asking questions at the deals? And no, we're doing something different. Now, even at that point, never in a million years did it ever cross my mind that doing something different was letting the guns cross the, you know, ride off into the sunset. But then other things started happening. Like, we had really good relationships with the dealers who used to call us. And I want to make this very clear because it's important, because I know people like to demonize the dealers, perhaps not your listeners, but the dealers would call us and we would roll out there and we would sometimes send an agent in so he could watch what was happening so we wouldn't have to have a dealer testify in court. And then, you know, obviously not standing out, he dressed like a regular person, and we would stop that car as it drove away. Then there were other times where the dealer would call us and we were perhaps out handling another call that we got from a dealer. So we weren't available. So those dealers would say, hey, we'll just tell them they didn't pass the NICS check yet. We'll have them come back tomorrow. Can you guys be here tomorrow? And we would do the same thing. Finally, if there were times where the dealer, we weren't available for whatever reason, the dealer would just not make the sale. But the dealers always called us. So, but what happened is, because we were seizing the firearms from the criminals before they made it to the street, the guns would never get traced. So, you know, and you know how a trace works. The manufacturer gets a call from ATF. Did you make this gun, the serial number? Yes, I sent it so-and-so. And then it ends at the first retail purchase. So the dealers weren't getting calls from ATF saying, hey, your gun was recovered, when we were out there. So all of a sudden, the dealers are getting calls saying, hey, your gun was found in Mexico. And they're like, well, wait a minute. We called ATF about that particular gun. Again, because the guns were walking. So right. Some of those dealers who trusted us started calling us saying, hey, can you tell us what's going on? And we were like, this doesn't make any sense to us either. So that's when we started to realize that the dealers were doing their part, and ATF, rather than doing their part in interdicting the firearms when we had probable cause to do so, we're just letting them ride off to the horizon. So think about this. I mean, I know in law enforcement and the military, we love to say never leave a man behind, right? These dealers were our friends. You know, these were good people who wanted to help protect the public. They were selling a lawful commodity. They were doing their duty. Well, we abandoned them by allowing them to continue to do this without doing those interdictions. So that's, you know, when we started to get those calls from the FFLs, that was another thing that was like, wait a minute, something different is going on here. And then Brian Terry got killed. And that's when John Dodson stepped forward. And then the water cooler talk started. And that's when I realized, holy shit, they're walking guns. Because I'll tell you, a lot of people, when John first stepped forward, thought John was lying, because it went so far against the grain of how he normally operated that even really people I respect within ATF didn't believe John was telling the truth. But it turned out he was.
Yeah, there's a moment in your book where you talk about this is after Dodson has come forward. I think maybe even right around the time that you came forward, but they're now trying to, you know, start to handle this spin publicly, right? So now it's okay. Now we got to make arrests. I want to quote from your book here. Everybody gets called in, right? So you got people who have not been on this case before, but now they're being roped in to help make these arrests. You wrote, "I watched as realization dawned on the faces of the people around me. First, stark, stunned silence, then whispers. They actually let guns walk, came a low voice behind me. I thought it was just office gossip. I can't believe it. I could still hear the denial in their voices. There's no way ATF agents would do this. Everything that we had thought must be rumor, because they were right. No ATF agent would do that, had now materialized in print in front of us as complete and utter truth. An uncomfortable silence descended, and as the meeting ended, people either drifted out with slightly haunted looks or indignant scowls. So this really did come as a shock to, it sounds like, almost everybody who was not directly involved in Fast and Furious when they found out what was actually going on.
Yeah, I'll go one step further. One of the gentlemen who's referenced in the book is a guy named Carlos Canino. Carlos was the attaché in Mexico. He was dealing directly with the Attorney General of Mexico. They had a friendship, which was very helpful in the Kingery case, which I spoke of later. But so Carlos had come up there for the takedown as well. And he's assigned to Mexico. So, I mean, you would think that Phoenix ATF would be talking to ATF Mexico, let them know what's going on. Well, Carlos was called on the carpet by the Attorney General, who, again, he was friends with, and asked about Fast and Furious. And he's like, no, this is not possible. We wouldn't do this. So Carlos himself came up to that briefing, and I was with Carlos, who was a pretty tough guy. Carlos was involved with Jay Dobbins when they infiltrated the Hells Angels in that famous case. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Carlos did a lot of undercover. He's not a soft guy by any stretch. Carlos literally read the operational plan and was at the briefing, and I watched him turn white as a sheet of paper and get weak-kneed, because he's like, Pete, I got to go back and tell the Attorney General that I've been effing lying to her all of this time. He goes, I never in a million years dreamed that this shit would be happening. He goes, but now I got to go tell Maricela, a friend of mine, that this stuff really happened. I mean, that's how deep this got at that particular meeting. And then what's worse is that evening, Bill Newell was questioned at a press conference by, it might have been Cheryl Atkinson, but I'm not sure who, but has ATF walk guns? And Bill's response was no. In fact, not only no, but hell no. That caused a firestorm of text messages and all kinds of, because people at this point, the cat was out of the bag, and people were really upset that he would just sit there and boldface lie at a press conference rather than take ownership of what turns out to be a horrific mistake. I mean, it's beyond defensible.
Well, and that's the thing. And you know, to this day, I don't think that anybody at DOJ or within ATF really took ownership of this. You know, yes, Ken Melson was dismissed. Yes, there were a couple of other folks who, you know, were demoted or reassigned. But, you know, one of the most depressing parts of your book, I got to say, Pete, is at the end when you kind of, where are they now? Right. And all of these folks who are still at their posts, they're still collecting their government paycheck. There was no accountability. There were no consequences for this. And I'm curious your feelings on that. When you see, you know, and one of the most engaging parts of your book, not necessarily from a good perspective, but when you talk about the hardships that you went through after you blew the whistle, having to sell, you know, pawn off, you know, guns from your personal collection, items that, you know, were near and dear to your heart because you had to pay legal bills. And you had to pay the mortgage and you had to pay, you know, for groceries. The hardships that you went through, how does it feel seeing folks like Emory Hurley still on the job, not having been disciplined in any meaningful way for what happened with Fast and Furious?
Look, it offends me. You know, look, I don't expect anybody who expects law enforcement to get it right every time is always going to be disappointed, because law enforcement officers make mistakes. When people make mistakes, they should be held accountable for those mistakes. Look, Emory basically walked away unscathed, you know, where you had other folks, myself, Larry Ault, the people who stepped forward all had to leave the state of Arizona. We all got beat up. And you mentioned the financial stuff I went through. It's very humbling when you're sitting there on your driveway selling your power tools and because you have to pay the next mortgage payment. And some guy is trying to talk you down for your $100 drill that you're trying to sell for $50 and he's offering you $10. It's incredibly humbling to go through that. But to see how the folks, many of which had the most blood on their hands, completely walked away from this scot-free, still is offensive to me, actually. And look, the fact that a lot of them weren't held accountable is partially why I wrote the book. The other part is Brian Terry was, by all accounts, a hero. I mean, he was served this country, Border Patrol guy. BORTAC is no joke. I mean, we saw what the BORTAC guy did in Uvalde, right? I mean, he pushed past those cops that weren't taking action and saved the day. I mean, that's just the nature of these Border Patrol guys. So he's the cream of the crop. And here he's killed in the line of duty by Mexican bandits who were looking to rob Mexican drug couriers on the border. And his family never got the answers that they justly deserved. So, I mean, which is another reason why I decided I wanted to write the book, is so that they could see what had happened there. It was just a complete colossal failure in leadership. And it went against the grain of everything I ever believed in law enforcement.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, you say law enforcement doesn't get it right every time. I agree with you. But this wasn't just an error, right? Because there were so many layers of approval. There were so many opportunities for somebody to just say, wait, how's this supposed to work? Explain to me how this works. Because that's the thing. Nobody can explain how this was supposed to successfully, right, lead to the capture of cartel leaders without the deaths of, you know, cartel members or innocent civilians. Because you had to let those guns walk, right? They didn't have GPS devices in these guns. They didn't have RFID chips that, you know, could track where these guns were going. The way that these guns were tracked is when they would show up at crime scenes, right? Yes. When they were used. So this wasn't just an error in judgment from my perspective. And I'm curious. Oh. I know that your book, again, is from your perspective. It's what you saw. It's what you heard. And you weren't at Main Justice. You weren't at DOJ.
Right.
But what do you think Eric Holder knew? How much do you think the top brass at DOJ knew about Fast and Furious before all of the shitstorm broke? And then how much did they know after and when the cover up really started?
Oh, listen, there were briefing papers that were put together that were pushed up. And I know for a fact that they made it all the way to the Attorney General's office. There was also a period during the early stages of what was Fast and Furious where representatives from the White House came out to the state of Arizona and had some sort of a meeting. I wasn't present at the meeting. And it's funny because during the thing that we spoke about at Newsmax, there was an agent there who worked for me in Yuma, Chris Bort. She struggled with the clock. We'll say that. He was actually a pretty good agent in the field. Chris was actually at that meeting and was so appalled by it that he went out and bought a Belgian FN-57 pistol because the tone of the meeting, they felt like the White House was looking to move to ban the Belgian, the FN-57, you know, as being a lawful pistol anymore. Because it was back then the Mexican police had nicknamed it the Mata Policia. So there was this, they were demonizing the gun, not surprising, right? But I don't know what the White House knew, but there's no way that Eric Holder, because I remember Obama said, well, I found out about it when everybody else found out about it, when I read it in the paper. Well, hey, that's some wingman, right? Hey, there's a train coming, pal, and your wingman doesn't tell you it's coming. So I don't believe any of that stuff. It just defies logic to think that Obama didn't at least have some familiarity with what's happening. But Eric Holder and people at the higher levels of the Department of Justice certainly knew what was happening because I'd seen the briefing papers, after the scandal broke. I know where those briefing papers go. Yeah. But I mean, that's just them being disingenuous and lying. And look, the cover-up, people say the cover-up is sometimes worse than the crime. Not here. Brian Terry's dead, right? So covering that up is not worse than murder of a Border Patrol agent. But there's countless people who were killed in Mexico. Not all of them are cartel people. And look, these firearms that were trafficked there, again, not to hunters, not to target shooters, to killers. They're not apples. They're not loaves of bread. They don't biodegrade. They don't disintegrate. Until they're recovered, they're going to keep dropping bodies in Mexico and here in the U.S. And it's... I would say the most appalling scandal in U.S. law enforcement history. And I don't know how you could minimize it and say it's anything less.
I can't disagree, honestly, Pete. I'm curious. We've only got a couple minutes left. How closely do you follow what's going on with the agency now that you're no longer with the ATF? And what is your impression of what the Biden administration has done with the agency? First, nominating David Chipman. After he was rejected, nominating Steve Dettelbach, obviously I have my opinions as to what the ATF has been doing over the past couple of years, but I'm curious to get your take.
Sure. I'm happy to give it. I do not agree at all with where Steve Dettelbach has taken the agency at all. He certainly, especially this name and shame thing, no director in my time with ATF would have ever even thought of such a thing. But he's my understanding, and I have friends, and I'm not going to name names. I don't get people in trouble. He's getting his marching orders from Rob Wilcox at the White House. He's in the office of the gun czar, former guy from Everytown. He's somewhat of a straw man. But look, we shouldn't be going after the industry, going back to what I said earlier. They were our partners. They were great sources of information. You know, they were people who were trying to run legitimate businesses. So going after them and crushing them, in my opinion, does nothing to protect public safety. Because what I'll say is Bitar Jones, who was appointed, by the way, by Barack Obama, and who came in to right the ship after Fast and Furious, and his successor, Tom Brandon, both Marines, they used to say overtly, hey, the industry is the first line of defense in protecting the public from gun crimes. We need to build this partnership. And we did. When Tom Brandon left, activists kind of took over ruling the roost at ATF, and things turned around. So I hope that at some point we get a director who recognizes the importance of going after violent people who are misusing guns, and stop going after the gun or the gun industry who are just there doing something that's protected by the Constitution. And like I said, who in many instances were very, very good citizens. I in my entire career, I only ran into one licensed dealer who was a dirty dealer. One. And we dealt with them all the time.
Pete, again, I cannot thank you enough for sharing your story, not only here at Bearing Arms, but putting it down on paper. The Deadly Path, How Operation Fast and Furious and Bad Lawyers Armed Mexican Cartels is a must read. And I hope that folks will pick it up. I honestly read it in one day, basically in one setting. I picked up the first two chapters, then I had to go to work. And then I read the rest of the book in one fell swoop, because it is just that gripping and that engaging. So thank you for joining me on the show today. I hope that we can we have you back to talk about stuff other than the book? Like if I have a question about the ATF or want to get your take on something, can I reach out to you?
Yeah, like I said, when this thing started, I'm a huge fan of your work. I find you to be an honest broker and a straight shooter, no pun intended. Yeah. I mean, reach out to me anytime. Be honored to chat with you again.
Well, I appreciate that. And I'm honored to have you on the show today. Pete Fricelli joining us here on Bearing Arms Cam and Company. I appreciate Pete joining me on the program. And we will be having him back again in the future, because I want to talk about some of Pete's other experiences within the ATF, as well as, getting his pulse on where the ATF is going here under Steve Dettelbach. You heard some of his initial comments, but I think that's worth exploring more deeply in the future as well. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking with Chuck Lovelace, who is one of the gun store owners in Wisconsin, who is helping gun owners temporarily store firearms if they need to, whether it's they're going out of town on vacation, whether there's somebody in the home who doesn't need to be around firearms for the moment. Chuck has gone public with this, and the reaction that he's received from the 2A community has actually been really receptive, which is a good thing. So we're going to be talking with Chuck firsthand about this, how other FFLs can get involved doing the same thing. That's coming up on tomorrow's Bearing Arms Cam and Company. But check out BearingArms.com throughout the day for the latest Second Amendment news and information. If you like what you see, I'd encourage you to become a VIP or VIP Gold member. Just go to BearingArms.com/subscribe. Use the promo code SAVEAMERICA, and you can get a significant savings. We're going to give you exclusive content you won't find anywhere else, because your support really does matter, and it truly does make a difference. So thank you again. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.